What does it mean to bring our whole selves into the world? To give ourselves the gift of unconditional acceptance? Join me as we learn together. I'm Jorgen Salvis, and this is Unshaming. Hey everyone, this is Jor, and this week we are unshaming physical disability. But before we get into that, I just wanted to say thank you so much for the outpouring of letters and messages that you've been sending through email and through Instagram, telling me what you're unshaming, telling me what you have unshamed, what you're looking forward to unshaming. This show really started as a response to my own shame story. I grew up gay in a pretty conservative part of Texas, very religious, Catholic. I'm first generation American and an immigrant. So shame is really layered into my own story. And unshaming was my response to that. So to see this podcast resonate with so many of you is just so special to me. So I had a thought. I want to tell your story on unshaming. So email the podcast at unshamingpodcasts@gmail.com and tell us what you are unshaming, what you have unshamed, and what you are looking forward to unshaming in 2021. And with your permission, I will tell your story on the podcast, or I'll post it to our Instagram. I am so looking forward to reading everything that you send our way, and I absolutely love hearing from you, and I want to make you a part of the show. So thank you so much again, and let's get into the story. The US CDC says that over 25% of all American adults have some kind of disability. So why is it that we rarely ever see disabled people represented in the media? I interviewed Barb Zablatoni. She was a small town girl from rural Pennsylvania with dreams of becoming a veterinary technician. She moved to Scranton, Pennsylvania to start achieving that goal and came home for Christmas one year. On her drive back to Scranton on December 30th, 2007, she hit some black ice. She lost complete control of her vehicle and crashed into trees in the surrounding area. She was paralyzed upon impact. That was the moment that changed her whole life. Battling with depression for years after her accident, she decided to take a chance and compete in the Miss Wheelchair Pennsylvania pageant. And in 2018, she won. Miss Wheelchair America is an organization that empowers disabled women through leadership, advocacy, and education. In this episode, we touch on a ton of different topics. But I think my biggest takeaway was the difficulty us humans have with accepting reality on reality's terms. That is, seeing reality as it is, rather than how we want to see it. Barb says it took her over 5 years to accept her disability. This got me thinking about how difficult it is to enjoy life when we're in denial about our reality. Because we give ourselves this false sense of hope that inevitably leads to disappointment. For example, instead of accepting and moving on from toxic people in our lives, we hold on to the hope that they'll change. Instead of accepting our bodies for how they are now, we tell ourselves, we'll be ready for the beach after a few more months of working out and dieting. Instead of accepting the fact that we need open communication from our partners, we play games in an effort to seem cool and like we don't actually care. But won't we be happier if we accept our authentic reality as it is in the only moment that actually exists, the present one? I know I'm supposed to be impartial, but this is one of my favorite episodes. I love everyone that comes on the podcast because they make me feel so hopeful about life and about the future. And for as much as I'm the host, I'm very much a listener too. So I hope you feel as inspired by these episodes as I do. This is The Shame of Physical Disability.
I remember before I left my home in here, my hometown, and my dad and I got in a fight. and I just left and headed back to Scranton. I remember the song I Wrecked My Car To, The Story of Your Life by Social Distortion. You know, I remember what it felt like to lose control of a vehicle. That's probably the moment you realize, and it's like a second. So I remember that feeling of dread. Once I took that wheel to the left, I just said, oh shit, I'm going to die. And then I remember the sound of the crunching metal and all that stuff. I just couldn't breathe. I remember struggling to breathe. When you can't breathe, that's also a very terrifying feeling.
So you were conscious?
Yes, I was conscious for the whole thing. Yeah. Yeah.
So do you remember any sensation in your back actually leaving you?
Yeah. So what's weird is, yeah, but like at the time I thought, oh, I broke my hips or something. That's why I can't feel what's going on. But I was on my back. Like I was folded in half with my legs up. Imagine laying on your back and you lift your legs up to your chest. You know, you take your legs and pull them all the way back, like past like your head.
And this is in a car. This is in the driver's seat.
Well, this was going through. I was in a 2002 two-door Cavalier. The space between the seats that I fit through, and I'm a 6 foot tall, like curvy girl here, was like the width of my hand. It was the weight of myself times the speed I was going is how many pounds of pressure was against my body in that moment of impact. And had I been wearing a seatbelt, obviously I wouldn't travel through the vehicle and I would have been in my seat, right? So for everyone listening, please wear your seatbelts.
After that, so you go to the hospital or did someone call the ambulance for you?
So my cell phone was in my back right pocket. I was trying to struggle first to get my legs off of me, but also struggled to reach that phone to try and call 911. And then I heard, you know, is anyone there? Is everyone okay? Is everyone alive? And I just started screaming, call 911. And they were like, we already did. They ended up taking an hour to get to me because of the conditions, and where my wreck location was at was kind of out of the way. And it took them an hour to cut apart my car. They cut off the roof and they cut out the driver's seat to be able to safely get me out of the vehicle. It took an hour to get me to the hospital again because of the conditions. And I remember being in the back of an ambulance and my body was going into shock. I remember my body was shaking like I was cold, but I was so hot. I've never felt that hot in my life. My body, I just wanted to go to sleep. That's all I wanted to do was go to sleep. And they kept slapping my face and putting like ammonia and stuff under my nose to keep me awake. And they kept saying, Barb, stay, you can't go to sleep. Your body, you can't let your body shut down. You have to stay awake. And they just kept trying to keep me awake. And then I remember puking everywhere. And it was just this whole thing. And once I got to the hospital, they, you know, realized quickly what was going on. The doctor came in, told me I was paralyzed and I would never walk again. He said, we're doing surgery right now to hope that the damage isn't permanent. And so I went right into surgery. And while I was going into surgery, my ex-fiance came at that time and I could hear his voice. And I remember him kissing me right before going into surgery. And then I woke up and he was sleeping in a chair next to me. And I remember never being in that much pain before. It was so bad. They ended up putting 2 rods and 9 pins into my spinal column to keep my back intact. And evidently I sustained permanent spinal cord injury damage. There is a bone shard in my spinal cord and they cannot remove it or they will cause more damage. And it is also believed that there might've been some stretching of the spinal cord as well. My official diagnosis is a T10 paraplegic incomplete spinal cord injury anterior cord syndrome.
So what was life like after that?
Honestly, it took me a long time to really process it. I remember it was all just about the rehab and going to rehab and trying to, you know, get me walking again. And they're, you know, telling me you have to live life, you know, in this chair. And I was like, no, I'm going to walk. You don't know, like, give me a chance, you know? And they were like, no, you have to live life in this chair. And the rehab facility I went to, there was only like 1 or 2 good therapists. The rest all treated me like I was not a person. And I was also 4 hours away from my family at rehab.
So after the injury, what was it like going back into everyday life? grocery shopping and getting dressed and living your city life. What was that like?
Well, I had to move back home because the apartment I resided in was on the third floor, and I evidently needed help all the time with almost every single task. So I had to move home. Ironically enough, my grandpa also had a spinal cord injury. And so my house was somewhat fitted to be accessible to some degree. So that's, I moved back in to my family's home. I had to give up my apartment. My ex-fiance had to pack everything up. I didn't even, you know, get to see it or help with the process. I did not want to let go of that life. I was clinging on to it, living a nostalgic idea in my head of everything's just, this is a nightmare, and it's just all going to go back to
how. You were still in denial.
Yes, I was 100% in denial. I think when you are 21 years old, the idea of forever is very hard to understand.
Totally.
And so when I had to move back home, you know, my family really stepped up, and we had to hire at the time some caregivers and stuff to help as well, because I literally couldn't do anything for myself. I could barely transfer. I could barely, you know, dress. I could, you know, I couldn't go to the bathroom on my own. When you get a
and Barb, tell us what does transfer mean?
Transferring means that from one surface to another, because I cannot stand and weight bear, you have to figure out how to now move your body to different surfaces. Yeah, I think that that was the hardest thing, was allowing people to help me with tasks like going to the bathroom, like going and getting a shower, like going and getting dressed, like basic things that I took for granted 100%, you know, before that day, things I never thought twice about that would be gone forever.
We talked a little bit about the physical transitioning. What was the mental transitioning like? Because you're saying you moved from a bigger town to your old small town again, and you were now moving back in with your parents. And what was that like? You know, that must, when I think about going through disability, I'm like, wow, you know, obviously the physical stuff, but what about the emotional stuff?
It was honestly a very hard transition mentally. I struggled with depression before my injury, but I struggled with depression, anxiety more so after my injury too. And, you know, I definitely had a hard time coming to terms with it all. You know, not even a year after my injury, I got paralyzed on 12/30 of 2007. And on 12/20 of 2008, my mom suddenly died in her sleep whenever I was only 22 years old. And she was my main caregiver. So I think that was almost worse for me to go through in that moment of my life than even getting injured, because she was my biggest cheerleader. She was such a huge support, both physically and emotionally. And the rest of my family works full time. So at that point, I was left home alone the majority of the day, all the time afterwards. It was very lonely, and it was very hard at that point. I really relied on my ex-fiance at the time as a crutch, essentially. And then in 2010, we ended up separating. And at that point, I just went into a severe depression. And I was in such a deep depression, I didn't even realize I was in a depression, because I was just trying to get through the next day.
So this is like in a span of a year. You have lost your bodily mobility. You've lost your mother and now a partner.
Yeah, my partner was then pretty much a year and a half later. So he struggled with PTSD from serving in our military, and he had his own issues that he had to address and come to terms with too, that he wouldn't do. And his actions were directly affecting me in an abusive sense. I had to make the decision essentially to sever ties. And when I made that decision, I knew I was severing ties with, you know, living in Scranton ever again, with finishing school there. I knew I was losing all my friends up, you know, I would probably not see them as much. I knew all that when I made that decision. And that was a very hard decision to make. But one thing about me is, even though I was going through that depression and stuff, I still loved who I was as a person. Deep down, I knew I was a good human being, and I knew my worth as a woman.
what was it like to have to humble yourself? You know, we talked a little bit about you needing to be bathed by someone else, needing to be dressed by someone else. And 21 years old, I mean, when I was 21, I thought I can do anything. Mm-hmm. You know, at that age, you think you know everything too, right? What was it like for you to humble yourself and accept that help from a few friends, a few people that I know that have been injured? I think that's one thing that really is difficult for them. They're so used to the independence, and suddenly now you have to lean on people to help you. So what was that like for you?
I really struggled with it. I didn't want to accept it. I was very angry. I was very combative. I threw a lot of things. I broke a lot of things. I use a transfer board to transfer, and the transfer board's all chewed up from me throwing it in anger and stuff. Now I look at it and remember that and see how far I come. So I'm weirdly attached to this transfer board. But I feel like it took, you know, once I severed ties with my ex-fiance, there was, you know, a period that I eventually just kind of was like, okay, this is it. And by year five, then, when I reached the 5-year mark of injury, at that point, I realized that this is it. This is permanent. I'm not gaining anything more back. And if I do, it's going to be minimum. I realized at that point, this is how the rest of my life is. And I can either continue being a miserable human being or be the change that I want to see in the world. 5 years in, I started realizing a lot of issues, and you start realizing how you yourself treated people with disabilities and looked down on them. And now you realize, holy crap, now I'm that person. That's how people are looking at me now.
Did you ever feel like a burden?
Oh, for sure. I definitely felt like a burden to my family. There was many family fights over it. There was many family altercations, you know. But ultimately, I would say the injury kind of made my family closer in a sense. And then when my mom died, it kind of forced us to be even closer and rally around each other. And we have a very small family. And it kind of made me realize what was truly important in life at a young age. I started realizing people who were my friends were really not my friends. They all kind of vanished. And I always, at times, I felt like a burden, but it took me a lot to realize, you know, I'm seeing it as an inconvenience to them, because perhaps if the roles were reversed, maybe me myself would not have done that for them. And I'm seeing it as an inconvenience because if I had to do it for them, I would have been inconvenienced at the time.
And so, you were projecting your own internalized feelings about disabled people onto yourself.
Yes.
As now a disabled person.
Exactly. And it's not like I didn't think that these people deserve to take up space, but, you know, I just felt like for whatever reason, I was superior over them. And I don't know where that came from. And I've been actually trying to rack my brain, you know, as I keep meeting people and as I keep learning, I keep trying to rack my brain where this would have come from. I feel like a lot of people are impatient when it comes to me because I move a little bit slower. I have to do things differently. And I feel like when people see me doing things differently, because I'm doing it differently, it's wrong. It just means that's how I've adapted. And like, even in public, I get sighs and eye rolls. Like if I'm in someone's way at a store, like I said, my grandpa had a spinal cord injury. My mom used a cane. You know, I had a sister who had a severe disability and died at the age 11 before I was born. And I've always heard about her, you know, so it was always in my circle, but it was peripheral enough that I didn't think it would ever happen to me.
Can you tell us one of the first stories you remember of being discriminated against or feeling really insecure when you had just been diagnosed with your disability, when it just happened?
As I started getting more independent in the community, I started realizing things too. It started with little things like me and my brother would go grocery shopping, and I swiped the card. I was the one that paid for these groceries, and they're handing him the receipt. They're handing him the change. Or like, we'd be out and they would be like, look at him and say, well, how's she doing? And he's like, she's right here. Ask. It was little things that I started realizing. I'm like, this is so backward.
And people not addressing you, but addressing the able-bodied person that you're with.
Yes.
They see. And why do you think that's the case?
I think because they look at me and it makes them uncomfortable. They don't know what to say. They don't know how to act. I ended up going out, maybe it was like 4 years ago now, on Black Friday. So I ended up having to go through a couple stores to get to where I needed to. Well, going through this one store, I was willing through it. And at the cross section, there was women, like a group of middle-aged older women standing there talking. And as I wheeled by, I heard, oh my God, why would she take her wheelchair out on Black Friday? And I quickly yelled back, because some of us aren't blessed with legs that work. Like, if I didn't need to take this, trust me, I wouldn't be taking it, you know, but I have to, or I couldn't be here. When I'm transferring into my car, I'll transfer into my vehicle, and then I break down my chair. I take each wheel off, I put them in. I take the base of my chair, I pull it up over me and put it in the back of my seat then. And then I do it in reverse when I get out. So it takes some time. It never fails. I'm in a parking lot and I'm doing this task. And someone, like the one time, this old guy came up and just yanked the base of my chair out of my hand and almost caused me to fall out of my car because I don't have good trunk control and balance. And so when I'm doing this, I have myself positioned in a way to kind of anchor myself for what I'm doing. But when you surprise me and pull something out of my balance, I end up falling. And so that's what almost happened, because he thought he was helping me, but really he could have just severely hurt me. And people are constantly saying, do you need help? Do you need help? Do you need help? And, you know, no one helps an able-bodied person get into their car. You know, no one has probably ever asked you, hey, do you need help getting in your car? You're like, what? No. Right. And so it reinforces that these people see me as not capable of doing this task, and not realizing if I needed help, I'd scream for help and say I need help. They don't even think I have a voice enough to ask for help. That's the part that I'm like, I worked hard to get this independence to be able to do this, like really hard. And now you're kind of infringing upon that. You're coming into my personal space. You're touching my wheelchair, which is directly a part of my body. And they see it as a piece of equipment, not a body part. So I've had males like come up and start pushing my chair behind me while I'm wheeling up a parking lot and moving my body where they want my body to move. And I'm like, can you please stop pushing me? And they're like, I'm helping you. I'm like, no, you're kidnapping me. You're moving my body where I'm, if I want to zigzag through a parking lot, that's up to me to make up where I want my body to go in space. And you're taking that right of moving my body away from me. This is a common everyday issue I deal with. I always tell people, rule of thumb, ask yourself, would you help an able-bodied person with this task? You know, when I need help, I'll say I need help.
What did all of these messages that you were getting, both directly and indirectly, how did that make you feel at that point?
So early on, I would say I had a lot of shame about it. Like, for some reason, I, again, internally was projecting these things onto myself. And I was very insecure with, I'm stuck in this new body that I can't move. You know, I'm gaining this weight because my metabolism is not the same because I'm not as moving as much. And, you know, I'm depressed and I'm eating my feelings away. And I started to feel all this type of shame for the bladder and bowel issues that go along when you have paralysis. And the accident.
What are those?
For my specific injury, a lot of people with paralysis will have bowel and bladder control issues. So for me, I can't feel when I need to go. I can't tell if I'm going, and I can't hold it. I don't know anything. So I tell people what my body feels like to me is a floating torso. So I have no feeling, sensation, or movement from pretty much the belly button level down. I don't know what's happening. It's anyone's guess. And so, you know, when you get that sensation, you know, you need to go to the bathroom. I don't get that sensation. I don't have the muscle tone to hold the bladder or the bowels. I don't know any of that. So typically what happens is you have accidents. You have to wear adult pull-ups, you know, at the age of 21. Do you want to wear adult pull-ups in your excrement out in public? You know, the bladder issues and the bowel issues were ultimately what was disabling me. I came to that conclusion by 5 years post-injury that, okay, I'm not gaining anything back. I'm not improving. I'm not getting anywhere. What are my options? And so there's some options available surgically to reroute your bladder, to you know, have a bag for your bowels, you know, and to and things like that. And so I started to explore those options. And essentially the doctor, in the nicest way possible, said, you're too fat to have these surgeries. And it was then I went to the gym and I saw a nutritionist and started the process of losing 100 pounds. And I did lose 100 pounds since quarantine. I've like gained 20 back, but still not what it was. But it was during that time that I got more active in the community and started realizing more this depression started lifting and I started being more clear and I started like, okay, I didn't talk to anyone else who had a disability. I kept to myself for the better part of a decade. You know, that was when I started to, like I said, start not having that shame anymore to just exist in public and to be who I was. I have a very bright color wheelchair. I trademarked the name Rolling Rainbow. Like, I realized if you can't stand up, you might as well stand out because people are staring at you anyways. You might as well give them something to stare at.
Tell us what Miss Wheelchair Pennsylvania is, and how did you find out about that?
My brother is a chiropractor, and his receptionist saw in the paper a little tiny thing of my predecessor press release or whatever saying that she was going to nationals. So it made it into our local paper. It was like literally the tiniest thing. And she cut it out and said, hey, you should do this. And I'm like, yeah, right. I'm not a pageant girl. I'm covered in tattoos. I really don't think that's for me. See ya. But there was something, a gut feeling inside me that I should look into it more. And I've learned to listen to my gut feeling. So I ended up looking into it more and realizing that it's not a pageant, but it's an advocacy-based organization to help, you know, educate society about people with disabilities and different platform issues people with disabilities face. And so it took me a while, but I made the decision to go for it and do it. And on March 3rd, 2018, I was crowned Miss Wheelchair Pennsylvania 2018. And that was my first time talking to my predecessor and whatnot. That was my first time being around other women with disabilities. I never was exposed to them. It was all a new learning experience and thinking.
And suddenly when you come in contact with people who are like you and you don't have to explain yourself and you're like, whoa, this is some crazy ass shit.
I was like, oh wow. Like, you know, my predecessor had that bowel or that bladder surgery that I was thinking about getting. You know, I started being able to reach out to people and like learn more, and my world started to slowly grow and grow. And I started to realize more and more how internally ableist I was. And ableism, for those that don't know, it's favoring able-bodied people over disabled people. So I was an ableist wheelchair user for the longest time. And, you know, I still catch myself randomly thinking certain ways, and I have to unthink these things. And I think that's what living with a disability, probably it's the hardest thing, is to deprogram yourself of what society has told you is okay and what's not and what's acceptable and what's not, you know. And
what were some of those, what are some examples of you deprogramming some of that internalized ableism?
Yeah. So for instance, just last year, a guy who also uses a wheelchair approached me and was flirty and stuff. And I was like, yeah, no, thank you. And that night I went to my hotel room and he wanted to meet up. We were at a conference and he wanted to meet up and I kind of flaked on him. And I sat there that night, like up to like 2-3 a.m. going, wow, Barb, how crappy is it of you that you're not going to give this guy an opportunity because he's also sitting in a wheelchair like yourself. You want people to see you for a person, but you're not seeing him as a person. You're just thinking of all the logistics that would go into being in a relationship potentially, or even dating someone with a similar disability to yourself. That's all. I was like, this logistically, I don't know how this is going to work, you know? And I was like, wow, like you are being superficial right now and you need to get over that. So the next day I, you know, reached out to him and whatnot. We talked and we exchanged numbers and we talked for a little bit, and then he ended up throwing at me the same excuse. So how ironic. And it's fine. Like, it's his journey he has to figure out.
So what about running Miss Wheelchair Pennsylvania? Now you're a leader in that community. What has that been like for you to now go from being a beneficiary of that to facilitating inclusive experiences for other women who are disabled?
Honestly, it's an honor of a lifetime to be able to give that opportunity to women to be able to accomplish what I was able to. The opportunity is there. You just have to take it. And I've noticed some women don't necessarily want to take it because they are insecure and they are, you know, they are dealing with a lot of what society projects onto them. Essentially, what I hope to accomplish is to have these women realize within themselves the potential and to really understand that just because they have a disability doesn't mean that they can't still make a difference, and that you can do what you want to do. And I'm helping to facilitate a platform for them to accomplish it just a little bit easier. The more visibility you bring to disability, the more normalized it is. We don't see representations of ourselves often. You know, now there's Barbie wheelchairs, now there's Hot Wheel wheelchairs. You know, they're starting to get inclusive lines, but it's still, how often do you see someone in a wheelchair in the media? How often do you see leaders in the media? You know, when you are planning an event, I learn stages are typically not accessible because we're not usually the leaders. We're just the ones in the audience. So they just need to make sure the audience part is accessible, not the leader stage it being accessible. You know, how often do you see that? And it's not used in an inspiration type way.
I totally agree with that, Barb. And that's kind of the purpose of unshaming, and also to represent people in their normal lives. I want to know more about your day-to-day life. What is it like getting ready and eating your dinner and cooking and seeing friends and having sex and dating, you know, things that we don't know a whole lot about in regard to people who have disabilities, because frankly, we don't really see them that often. It's kind of taboo even to talk about it a little bit and to ask.
So, you know, a typical day for me, you know, going to the bathroom takes up a lot of time. You know, you have to plan your bowel routine. If you shower every day, that takes up a lot of time and energy. Just waking up and your body is usually very tight and spastic, and you got a lot of spasms and you're in a lot of pain because, you know, you're stuck sleeping on your back, don't move and roll at night because you're paralyzed, you know? So, you know, just the waking up process is a chore in itself half the time. I live in like the oldest state in the union. And so as a result, a lot of the houses here are built forever ago and are old, and as a result, not accessible. So I can't usually go and visit friends. I haven't been to a friend's home until recently when my best friend bought a house and my dad had to build a makeshift ramp to get into her house. And that was the first time I've been to a friend's house in over a decade. And so when you are dating, most of the time their houses aren't accessible and I live with my dad. So am I going to want to bring him back to like my room? No, like bring him back to my house? No, not till it's like something serious. Right. So it's like, well, what do I do? Like if we want private time, like where do we go? I guess a hotel, like, you know, and that gets expensive after a while. So, you know, there's just a lot of barriers still in just the daily life that I've just kind of gotten used to and have accepted as.
Sounds like a lot of planning too.
Yeah. So like we have to literally plan like 20 steps ahead of the game. Again, like I said, dating has that barrier. You know, having sex with my type of injury is, you know, I'm straight. I may not have full sensation, but I can still enjoy the moment and I can still have intimacy and love and pleasure. You know, it just looks different now than it did. And it's 100% not the same, but it's still enjoyable. But the thing is finding like a guy who can understand that. I'm open to dating and I'm open to it, but I'm not in a rush and looking for it right now because I'm trying to focus on bettering my life and more or less dating myself. Like if I come across someone who also has similar passions to me in this process, perhaps that's where I'm going to find, you know, the one.
Earlier you mentioned to me, this is a blessing. You feel like this is a blessing. What do you mean by that?
I believe this is a blessing for so many reasons. One, I think in general, it made me a better human being. I think it made me more aware of other people and their experiences. It made me see other people's struggles more so and feel for them. It made me realize my privileges. I always go back to the Miss Wheelchair Pennsylvania organization because honestly, that was the turning point in my life. I never had a sense of belonging and community before. And for the first time, I feel like I'm where I belong in life. I feel more complete than I did before my injury. I understand myself a little bit better than before my injury. And I'm sure these are things that come with, you know, maturing as well. But I think it's given me a unique perspective. Perhaps all along I was meant to help disabled people and I just didn't know it. And if I change one person's perspective on disability, then it's all worth it.
What gives you hope?
It's hard nowadays to have that, right? I think a lot of people are struggling with that during a pandemic and the political climate and the social uprisings and all that stuff that we're, you know, currently facing as a nation. But the first smaller hope is I see these women that I'm a small piece in their puzzle of helping them to find themselves and their voices to help be the change they want to see. And on a bigger scale, I would say the hope is within my community, the people I associate with within the disability community. The majority of them are such amazing human beings, and all of them all have very similar passions and purpose of trying to change the world for people with disabilities and to educate on some level. And I learn something from them almost every day. Disability is a natural part of human life. And if you live long enough, everyone's going to get a disability, whether it's temporary or permanent.
Thank you so much for telling your story, Barb.
No problem.
I'm Jorgen Salvis, and you've been listening to Unshaming. For more information about anyone featured on the show, follow us on Instagram at Unshaming or visit unshamingpodcast.com. If you liked this episode, leave us a review on Apple Podcasts. Special thanks to Mirzi for generously providing us with her original music. You can find her wherever you stream. If you have questions or want to tell us what you're unshaming, DM us on Instagram or email us at unshamingpodcast@gmail.com. Thanks for listening. I'll see you next time.